We've been talking about holiness all this time, and maybe you've noticed that I've neglected to define the meaning of holiness, that there's a method to my madness. There's a reason why I've taken all this time to move up to the task of definition, and that's because I'm trying to postpone it as long as possible, because it's so extremely difficult to pinpoint exactly what the Bible means by holiness. There's something about the very nature of holiness that's elusive, mysterious, hard to make concrete by way of definition. But we're going to try to do that now and see if we can come up with a deeper and fresh, if possible, understanding of what the Bible means by holiness. There's another reason, incidentally, that makes the definition of holiness difficult, and that's because the Bible uses the term holy in more than one way. Normally, in two different ways, and the plot thickens even more by the fact that it is the secondary meaning of holiness that is most commonly perceived as the total meaning of holiness. Let me explain what I mean by going to the board here for a second. When I ask people, what does the word holy mean to you? The normal kind of response I get is something like this, that holiness has reference to behavior, to righteousness, to morality. Well, there's a sense in which the holiness of God touches upon these things, and the secondary meaning of holiness in the Bible calls attention to the purity of God. The fact that in God we find moral perfection. There is no shadow of turning within Him. There is no blemish. There is no defect in His character. That all of His behavior is absolutely righteous and pure. Now, again, as I say, that is one of the meanings of holiness in the Bible. But it's not the primary meaning. The primary meaning of holiness in the Bible is the what we call the concept of separation or consecration, or, to make it more simple, the whole idea of apartness. There is a kind of apartheid that we find in Scripture that has reference to God. For example, when things are sanctified in the Old Testament, what happens? They are set apart from a common usage to a special usage. They are made holy. And even the New Testament word saints that Christians are called, the hagioi, the holy ones. What does it mean that we are saints? Does it mean that we're perfectly righteous? You know better than that. When Paul writes to the churches, he says to the saints at Corinth, now you have to stop all this sinning that's going on there in the church. He's not addressing himself to perfect people. But he is addressing himself to people who have been set apart, who are called out from this world to be different, to be transformed by the presence and the power of the Holy Spirit, who is a different spirit. Now, this concept of apartness calls attention to the sense in which God is what we say other. God is other. Now, this is what makes defining the content of holiness so difficult. If its meaning calls attention to the sense in which God Himself is different from us, He's other than we are, how in the world are we going to define it in detail? Since we need to have some kind of similarity between us in order to describe God at all. And there are ways in which God is like us and we are like God. We are created in His image. But when the Bible speaks of God's holiness, it's a sense in which the voice of God is crying out from heaven and saying, wait a minute, don't think that just because there are ways that I have made you like me, that I've created you in my image, that therefore we're identical. Don't ever forget the difference between who I am and who you are. Now, if there's a theological term, I don't think I'll bother to write it on the board because I always have trouble spelling it. If there's one theological term that captures this concept of the otherness of God, it is the word transcendence. Now, you've heard that word. Something that transcends another thing is that which is above and beyond the commonplace. And it's the transcendence of God that points to the difference between Him and us. Just the other day, I was standing out on my porch at night, and I was looking up into the heavens and having the same kind of experience that we all have on a starry night, considering the brightness of the stars and thinking of the immensity of space. And as I tried to count the stars, and I thought about the fact that each one of those stars up in the sky was a sun, and that perhaps there were planets revolving around those stars, and I couldn't count the stars, they were innumerable. And I remembered that the distance between the Earth and the nearest one of those stars is, of course, the distance between the Earth and the Sun, which is 93 million miles. But the very next star, if you want to get off at the next station, if you want to take an interplanetary local rather than the express, and you stop first at the Sun and then you go to the next star, do you have any idea how far away it is? Here's the question. If we allowed a graph where 1 inch equaled 1 million miles, how far do you suppose it would be between the Earth and the nearest star apart from the Sun? Each inch is 1 million miles. Would it be 50 feet? 500 feet? 5,000 feet? How many think it'd be 50 feet? Nobody. How many of you think it'd be 500 feet? How about 5,000 feet? Yeah, look at the hands go up, huh? No, I tricked you. They're all wrong. If 1 inch were 1 million miles, the distance from the Earth to the nearest star would be the distance from Pittsburgh to Chicago. Every inch means 1 million miles. And I was thinking of that as I looked up at the sky. And I was feeling extremely insignificant. And I'd also received word that day of the death of one of my friends, a fellow that I went to school with in Europe, who after 13 years of battling with Hodgkin's disease finally died just the other night. And whenever a friend dies or a family member dies, I think we tend to be reminded of how fragile we are. That we are creatures. That we are dependent. And I began to think of my own life and my own ministry and of the things that I'm concerned about now, and I thought, in light of the immensity of space, and of all of the time that has gone on in world history, what difference does it make what I do this week? I'm all concerned about making this presentation this week and the holiness of God. And I said, well, 20 years from now, it won't even bother me. Time passes. I thought about my friend over here on the mantle, this fella here. And I've often wondered who he is. This picture normally hangs in my living room. And people come in and they see a portrait there of Stonewall Jackson, they recognize him, and then they'll say to me, well, who's that fellow? We don't know who he is. And I say, well, that's my great-great-grandfather who was in the Parliament in Ireland. And I give this big cock and bull story about this very distinguished-looking gentleman, but the truth of the matter is I have no idea who that fellow is or why there was an occasion for him to be seated to have his portrait painted. Why do you suppose he wanted his portrait painted? To be made immortal on canvas, because he knew that there would be a day when he would pass from the scene and be no more. I brought something from my house this morning that I'd like you to see that also communicates to me the sense of fragileness of being human. If you look at this, I don't know what we call it, a plaque or what, can you see that the texture of it and the fact that this is obviously very old? This replica, my wife says, don't call it a portrait. She says, call it a replica. I said, it looks like a portrait to me, but in any case, whatever it is the likeness of a human face, and it adorned a temple once in the ancient world. And this piece that I have in my hand is over 2,000 years old. And you can see how it's been worn through the erosion and the abrasions of sand and of time passing in world history. This particular item was salvaged from the ruins of Pompeii. This actually went through the destruction of Pompeii from Mount Vesuvius, wasn't it? Not Mount Etna. And only in recent days, they've discovered the hidden village of Herculaneum, where some 3,000 people were buried alive by the same catastrophe in the ancient world. And National Geographic magazine had vivid and graphic photos of the tragedy, where people were frozen, as it were, in the moment of the disaster, with mothers huddling their children. A soldier on duty and was instantly destroyed by this volcano. Well, all of these little items remind us of the thing that we don't like to think about, that we are mortal, fragile. In a word, we are creatures. And when the Bible speaks about the transcendent holiness of God, the Bible is saying to us that whatever is involved in creatureliness, God is above and beyond that. I am finite. God is infinite. I'm temporal. God is eternal. I'm conditioned. God is unconditioned. I'm dependent. God is independent. God stands above and beyond. And let me just for a moment, please, indulge me. Let me get abstract for a second. Let me go back to my porch and looking at the stars and thinking about my friend who died. I started asking myself the question that comes into my mind at least once a week, so you'll know how daffy I really am. The question that came into my mind when I was on my porch was this: why is there something rather than nothing? Why are there dogs? Why are there birds? Why are there trees? Why is there me? Why is there you? Have you ever asked yourself that question? Or am I nuts? Am I the only one that sits around and worries about questions like that? Why? I mean, I know that we have come a remarkable way. We've made enormous strides in terms of modern technology and modern science of the probing the intricacies of anatomy and of biology and of chemistry. And now we can isolate different kinds of strands of RNA and DNA and all of those aspects that go into making up a human being. And we think that we now are able to understand what life is. We even talk about test tube babies, which is a misnomer if there ever was one. Nobody's making life in a test tube, except that you're putting together eggs and sperms in a Petri dish or something like that. But all of this intricate knowledge that we have, nobody is answering the question why there is something rather than nothing. Why does anything exist ultimately? Do you ever ask those kind of questions? They plague me. Why is there such a thing as this piece of chalk? And I say, that piece of chalk exists. Doesn't it exist? Do you agree that it exists? Do you see it? Do you feel it? Do you think it? Do you believe that it exists? My shoe exists? Does that exist? You believe it exists. You know I can prove it exists. All right. Why are there things that exist? Somewhere, somehow, dear friends, something must have the power of being in itself. There once was a time when I didn't exist. There was a time when this piece of chalk didn't exist. There was a time when those stars didn't exist. But there was never a time when nothing existed. Because if there was a time when there was absolutely nothing, what would there be now? Absolute nothingness. You see, for something to be, there must be being. There must be the power of being, transcendent being, the power that has that being in and of itself, that doesn't need water, that doesn't need air, that doesn't need molecular gases or anything like that, but it simply has the eternal power of being in itself. And whatever that is not a creature. Whatever that is holy. And when the Bible speaks of God's holiness, it speaks of that awesome, majestic,
transcendent otherness by which he is so different from we. He has the power of being. He can bring something out of nothing. He can bring life out of death, and you can't do that, and I can't do that. And that's awesome. Early in this century, a scholar did a study not only of the theology of holiness, but also of the sociology of holiness. And a classic was written at the beginning of the 20th century by this German scholar by the name of Rudolf Otto. And what he did was he went around and he studied different groups of people, primitive tribes, cultured civilizations, and he said, I'm going to study man and how man reacts to whatever he conceives of as being holy, so that we can get in touch with human feelings and human responses to the transcendent. And in doing this, Rudolf Otto said, he coined a term, he said, what we regard as holy, he called the numinous. Now that is an abstraction, isn't it? And maybe no one in this room can define the word numinous, but does the very sound of it give you a hint as to its meaning? There's something ethereal about it. There's something very eerie and strange about it. And Otto went further, and he used some more language to describe the human sense of the holy, and he described the holy with this particular phrase, borrowing from the Latin, the mysterium tremendum. Bear with me. I have my students in the seminary, and one time I asked a student an answer to a question. I said, Mr. So-and-so, I said, what's the answer to this question? He said, I don't know, but I'm sure you have a Latin term for it. We have, can't get along without my Latin. Mysterium tremendum. I love the term. I like the way it just sort of flows from the lips, don't you? Otto is saying that if you want to crystallize the concept of the holy, you boil it down to these two words, mysterium and tremendous. It is that which provokes a sense of mystery and that which incites within us tremors, trembling, a sense of fear. I've wondered about that, and I've thought often about the phenomenon of broadcast radio in the 30s and in the 40s, before the advent of television. When I was a kid, I was addicted to radio shows. I mean, I had my ear next to that old Philco radio all the time, and George here remembers those good programs that we listened to, like the soap operas and the young Dr. Malone and Portia Faces Life and Ma Perkins and Our Gal Sunday, How Am I Doing? And Larry said to Mary, Larry. And Mary said to Larry. No, Larry said to Mary, Mary. And Mary said to Larry, Larry. Been a Mary Noble, backstage wife. Remember that? Stella Dallas, Lorenzo Jones' wife. All day long. And in the evening, the adventure stories, Tom Mix and Superman and all. But the best thing about television that would incite my, or radio, but would incite my imagination were the mystery stories. Gangbusters. The Shadow. Remember The Shadow? Mr. Keene, Tracer of Lost Persons. And then there was one called Suspense. And they were designed to frighten you to death. But the scary show of all scary shows came on Sunday night. And the announcer, his voice would come through like a hollow echo chamber, big, deep bass voice. But before the lead-in announcement was made telling the title of the program, first there was a sound of an ancient crypt being open, squeaking. Remember that? And then this voice would come on and announce the name of the program, Inner Sanctum. Boy, I'd be scared before the program even starts, just as soon as the guy said Inner Sanctum. You know, the hair in the back of my neck would stand up. An interesting phenomenon that when the world of radio wanted to come up with a program that would be the scariest program they could think of, they named it Inner what? inner tremendum, inner suspensum, inner sanctum. What does that mean? It means, literally, within the holy. Within the holy. The word sanctus, of course, is the Latin for holy. And they understood that nothing is more frightening to us than to be brought near, to come close, to step inside that place that is holy. We may be frightened by graveyards, or by murderers, by Jack the Ripper, but nothing is more terrifying than the holy. It's a point, incidentally, that Sigmund Freud never quite understood. Because he and other psychologists in the 19th century have told us that there is no God, that we've invented a God. And the reason why we invent a God is that because we're frightened by nature. We're aware of our creatureliness, and we're afraid of becoming sick and dying or being destroyed by the volcano or the earthquake or the fire. And so man, out of his fear of nature, invents a benevolent God who controls all of these forces, who stands above the hurricane and above the storm and above the flood. And if we pray to him or make sacrifices to him or promise to serve him, we can appease his wrath and cause him to treat us kindly. If we get on the good side of God, we can overcome our fear of nature. But what Freud never understood was that there was something that human beings fear even more than they fear death. They fear coming into the presence of a transcendent, holy God. That is what is terrifying. If I'm going to invent a God, he's going to be benevolent, but he sure is not going to be holy. Because holiness terrifies me. As the Negro spiritual says, sometimes it causes me to tremble, tremble, tremble. The mysterium tremendum. Well, Otto added to this concept of the mysterium tremendum what he called the mysterium fascinans. And he says that really, men, if we examine them in their cultures and in their environment, have an ambivalent feeling. They have mixed feelings toward whatever it is they regard as holy. There's a sense in which there's that conflict between attraction and repulsion, kind of a love-hate relationship. We're terrified by the holy, yet at the same time, we're fascinated by it. Look, for example, at the appeal we have seen of the occult. The occult is mysterious. The occult borders on the supernatural. And people sort of like to come up close to the occult and peer at it and play with it. But they don't want to get too close. They're like my wife. She's the best example I know of the ambivalence towards things that are frightening. You know what my wife likes to do? She likes to go and see scary movies. You know what I don't like to do? It's not that I don't like to see scary movies. I'm happy to see scary movies. I don't like to see scary movies with my wife. It's not the movie that scares me. It's my wife that scares me. Because, oh, please, let's go see When a Stranger Calls. Let's go see Friday the 13th. Let's go see one of these awful, scary horror pictures that Hollywood puts out. And I go there, and I pay money to be frightened. Isn't that insane? People go to haunted houses, pay money to go in there to get scared. Well, I go into the movie with her, and we're sitting there, and the first thing is, I feel this hand on my arm. And it starts to hurt. She's squeezing. There's no blood going through my arm anymore. She's got a death grip on my arm. And then the next thing you know, I can feel her get tense. And then I look over, and she's got her hands over. And she says, tell me when I can look. And then the next thing you know, she says, I'll be back. And she gets up and goes to the back of the theater and finds a solid wall back there that she can stand against so that she's sure nobody's behind her going to reach out and grab her. And the whole time, she thinks
She's having a good time. Now, that's what Rudolph Otto was talking about. We tell ghost stories. We rubberneck at accidents. We're fascinated by what is frightening. We're fascinated by what is holy. And that fascination attracts us. We want to know a little bit more about it. But as soon as we draw near, as soon as we come close, as soon as we get right up to the threshold of the Sanctus Sanctorum, of the Holy of Holies, then we shrink back in horror and we flee. And that's what characterizes our life, basically. A life of fleeing from intimate contact with holiness. We are not comfortable in the immediate presence of God. And this is especially true, I think, with respect to Jesus. We can appreciate Jesus from a distance. We can say nice things about God from a distance. But if we come too close, we're terrified. What I want to do in the next segment is to look at the world's reaction to Jesus, and to look at the contemporaries of Jesus' reaction to him, and explore further this sense of ambivalence that we have to transcend.